Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Lydon in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A new shot has been fired in a little culture war that has brewed for years between Greece and Great Britain. A gleaming modern museum now sits at the foot of the Acropolis of Athens. The aging Parthenon fills the museum's wide windows, but a good half of its most exquisite statues, gods, centaurs, maidens, stand frozen in battle and love in London's British Museum, and Greece wants them back. This hour on Point, who owns and who deserves the Elgin marbles? You can join the conversation. What do you think? Do history's greatest works of art belong where they were made? Or are the world's great museums a better place to preserve and admire our treasures? And you can also comment, of course, on our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And joining me from Athens, Greece, is John Seropoulos. He's the editor-in-chief and columnist of the Greek daily newspaper, Athens News, and also Athens correspondent for NPR. Hello, John.
Hello, Jackie.
I hope I got your last name right, sir.
Oh, yes, thank you. That's very conscientious of you.
John, would you please, before we even get to the controversy between Greece and Great Britain, tell us a little bit more about the Elgin marbles. I'm asking you to play historian here because perhaps not everyone knows exactly what they are. What was removed from Greece back at the beginning of the 19th century by the Earl of Elgin?
Right. Well, basically friezes that show, archaeologists believe, a procession that was held every 4 years to honor the patron goddess of the city of Athens, Athena. And it's taken a number of years to agree on that, but that's the consensus opinion. Now, Lord Elgin saw these things back in the beginning of the 19th century, liked them very much, obtained permission from the Sultan to apparently make copies of them. But in the process of doing so, he decided that it was necessary to remove them from where they sat at the upper reaches of the temple of Athena on the Acropolis in Athens, mm-hmm. the Parthenon. And once that was done, he, it seems, felt tempted to shave off the sculpted sides of these blocks and to take them back home, take many of them back home with him to England. The collection that's now known as the Elgin Marbles, and which Greeks refer to as the Parthenon Marbles, was finally sold to the British public because Lord Elgin went broke and became, in 1817, the property of the British Museum. Not exactly property. It's the property of the British public, but it's on permanent loan and display to the British Museum.
Right. And we'll be talking to the British Museum later in the show. And a purpose-built wing was created for them there, and so they have been there ever since. Mm. But now
That's
comes
right.
this fabulous new Acropolis Museum, which opens this summer in Athens, and renewed demand for their return. First of all, there have been recent articles by Christopher Hitchens and Michael Kimmelman, the art critic for the New York Times, about this museum. Have you been there?
Yes, I saw it for the first time on its official inauguration last Saturday night. And one thing I have to say, whether you agree with the repatriation or the reunification of the marbles or not, this museum does offer one very important thing. It gives you a gallery on the top floor in which the two sets of friezes, there are actually two sets. One is a continuous frieze, mm-hmm. and the other is a set of isolated metopes, as they're called. So imagine a cartoon book with distinct images with small gaps between them. Both the frieze and the metopes, the frieze stood under the colonnade of the Parthenon, so in the eaves, as it were, and the metopes stood on the outside of the temple facing the elements. Both of these are displayed in their relative positions so that you can see one behind the other, and they're both displayed facing outwards so that walking around the notional temple.
Mm-hmm.
That has never been done before. The display in the British Museum is in-facing. It's a classic museum display with things on the walls around the room. But it is exactly inverted from what it would have been originally. The other thing that this new gallery does in Athens is that it displays copies, plaster copies, of the missing pieces next to the ones, between the ones that are still in Greece, the originals. Hmm. And that enables you to see a more comprehensive view of the frieze than you were ever able to do before. The British Museum was kind enough to donate these plaster casts, which are one of three sets of original casts made by Elgin. I think in an effort to save his fortune from bankruptcy, he sold these this very limited edition. But he didn't succeed.
You know, John Soropoulos, it's so interesting as you're talking. I'm just wondering if technology and architecture are driving this archaeological argument, because if indeed this is the first time that visitors, and certainly including indigenous Greeks, can look at this in a sense of entirety, perhaps that helps impassion the desire for the return of the marbles themselves.
Well, it's not so much a question of new technology. It's just better display and a better museum, a more modern museum that has more space for you mm-hmm. to walk around and enable you to actually take in what you're seeing. The old one was more cramped. I think that what the Greeks have done here is this. Back in you may remember in the mid 90s, the Greeks were in the running for hosting the 1996 Centennial Olympic Games. And the arguments that the Greeks used then were very, very sentimental. It was the Centennial Games. Athens had hosted the first Olympics 100 years before. It made sense to bring them back home, the Greeks said. And the IOC was focused on technical arguments like, are you ready? Do you have the facilities and the venues? And the Greeks couldn't really convincingly address those issues. The same thing has happened here. The original arguments for reunification were repatriation. They're ours, we want them back. Now, it's technical. We've got the best museum in the world to house these things. What, doesn't it make sense to reunify them?
Right.
So the Greeks have come full circle from sentimentality to hard technical arguments that needn't offend you if you're British and needn't necessarily find you a sentimental nationalistic ally if you're Greek. It's attempting to appeal to the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, is the best argument that can be made at the moment with this debate being so emotionally charged.
Sounds like you're outdoors looking at them. You're not, are you?
No, I am out on the streets of Athens.
Well, you talked about the old nationalistic argument. That wasn't Melina Mercouri, the actress involved in that at one time?
That's right. She was culture minister, and it's a credit to her that she was the only minister who made it through every single reshuffle of 8 years of socialist government between 1981 and 89. She was very well loved.
And the Parthenon had undergone a lot of assault over time. I mean, at one time, there was a swastika flying on it, and it was, of course, taken down. So now is a chance to restore everything.
That's right. The Parthenon restoration has been ongoing since the mid-80s. It's actually supposed to be finished by 2016, I think. And what has happened is a couple of things. All the different, anyone who's visited the Acropolis in the last, more than 15 or 20 years ago will remember that there was lots of rubble strewn about the site. All of that was picked up, and if its original place could be found, it was put back in its place, and supporting pieces of masonry were cut to fill any gaps. And a lot of stuff that was simply not being displayed that was worthwhile was picked up and put on display. So now if you visit the Acropolis, you have a very different sight. You see that all the temples on the Acropolis now have old and new marble in them. They are more complete than they've ever been before, but in a nod to archaeological conservatism, they haven't been reconstructed overly much. You don't have, 25% of new material in there or anything.
John, just remind us that, as we grow short on this segment of our show, that last week the culture minister did renew the demand that the marbles be returned, right?
Very much so. He actually was more assertive than that. He said the marbles will return. He said the marbles are calling the marbles, in a sense.
You know, all right.
There's a homing beacon, as it were. He was very assertive. The Prime Minister and the President of Greece, to a much more diplomatic way, also gave out the basic message that we'd like them back. But at this point, a lot of the people who attended the opening of the museum felt that a new page has been turned in the campaign. The chances of the eventual return of the marbles have gone up a lot. It's a question of how and when, and under what particular legal arrangements. Will it be an actual gift of the British state to Greece? Will it be a permanent loan to the Acropolis Museum? But of things that for the foreseeable future remain the property of the British public, we don't know. The minister did offer a formula. He said, give them back, and to help you fill the Duveen Gallery at the British Museum, we'll give you rotating exhibitions of other Greek things. And there will always be something on loan to you.
Right.
So that's also a possibility.
Well, it's fascinating. And we really thank you for running us through that history. And we're going to say goodbye to you now. Goodbye.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
John Sarafopoulos, thank you. This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about culture, heritage, and battles over national identity, all wrapped up in a collection of ancient Greek statues called the Elgin Marbles. Joining me from London now is Konstantinos Politos. He's a Greek, a classical archaeologist, and ironically, he's actually speaking to us from somewhere in the bowels of the British Museum. And from Athens is John Brady Kiesling, a former U.S. diplomat and a trained classical archaeologist, now a lecturer and a columnist. He lives in the Plaka neighborhood, just at the foot of the Acropolis, and joins us from his home there. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Hi, Jackie.
Hi there. Well, would you mind if we started, please, with you, Konstantinos Politos? I'd really like to learn what the British Museum reaction has been to this assertion by the Greek culture minister that the marbles will someday be returned to Athens.
Well, first of all, I should say I cannot represent the British Museum and its opinions, but a very brief answer to your question is no. It's absolutely, there's absolutely no possibility at the moment that they would be returned.
Can you explain why that is? I understand that you are not speaking for the museum. You are just elucidating.
I'm not speaking for the museum, but at the same time, the answer here is quite categorically no. Why? Because they legally belong to the British public, and as far as the Britain, the state, the government of Britain.
Oh, it seems as if we may have lost Konstantinos, at least for a moment. Let's hope that John Brady Kiesling is still with us from Athens. John, can you hear us?
I can indeed.
Well, maybe you can respond to that. I wasn't really intending to take the mic away from our Greek archaeologist at the British Museum, but what do you think of that, if that is the official British position?
The official British position on ownership is somewhat obscure. Obviously, the marbles were purchased through bribery, corruption, rival imperial fanaticisms, and other models of human behavior we would like to have passed by. To be fair to the British and to Lord Elgin, one still needs to pay bribes in this part of the world in order to do business, so that element should not undermine the legal claim. The claim that's really of interest, though, is the moral and functional claim. We should go back and look at what the marbles represent. The Parthenon is a monument to the imperial grandeur of the city of Athens at a brief moment in history when it controlled a substantial, more or less democratic, more or less benevolent defensive empire, somewhat on the model of NATO. By building the Parthenon, Pericles and his colleagues intended to symbolize that their empire was moral and virtuous under a supreme, highly effective goddess Athena, that they were spreading logic and civilization all around and therefore don't mess with us.
Well, it's one of the reasons you build monuments, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes, but now we come to the modern age where what we see is not the monument to Athena of the 5th century B.C. Instead, we see the battered remains of white marble that have been purified essentially by a political art historical debate that has turned them into something they never were. They have, basically, from the 18th century on, we have invented a model of Greek civilization, of classical perfection, which has no relationship to how the ancient Athenians were, has no relationship to how the modern Athenians are, but which plays a very destructive role in modern Greek society, where Greece positions itself with relation to a artificially perfect, non-existent model. And when, by plunking the Parthenon marbles back into the museum, we would only confirm that problematic view of their history. But there's a better solution.
And what do you think that is?
Well, everyone will hate me, but there is only one place where the Parthenon marbles belong, and that is on the Parthenon. These are not self-standing statues designed to be looked at from close up. These are an integral architectural complex with a very specific message. That message makes no sense when you take it off the rock of the Acropolis, when you take it away from the Temple of Athena. It should be up there for people to brood on the fate of empires, on the fate of good intentions, in the way that God intended.
It sounds like Ozymandias, but it also sounds, you are a former diplomat, and that also sounds like a diplomatic solution. Not one, however, that we're likely to see, I think, no matter what happens to these things. But very, very interesting. And you make a point that they have come to represent something else. Let's go back to London. We're being rejoined by Konstantinos Politis, and we're sorry that we lost you there for the moment, because you were telling us that these belong to the British public, and at least at the moment, there really is no plan to return them back to this new Acropolis Museum.
Absolutely. There's no plan whatsoever, and it's hardly even really being discussed. It's if you believe in the rule of law, and I suppose in Western, at least Western democracies, we believe in the rule of law. This is laws and legal agreements are the most important factor. So because of this, the British will always use the legal claim as being the most important factor, that they will not ever be returned. Having said that, I think recently the popular mood, the popular opinion in Britain and probably in much of the world is that they should be returned.
Well, there's been at least a number of opinion polls showing that a majority of the British public does think that it's fine for them to go back to
Athens. And the more the Greek people and Greek governments make the claim and show that they really want them, I think it underlines the point to the British public that they don't feel as strongly about it as the Greek people may feel.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are other items, surely, in the British Museum that represent Greece. You work there in that collection that perhaps could take their place if they were returned.
Well, first of all, where the galleries were, so-called Elgin marbles are housed, were purpose-built for that collection of sculpture. Yes, there are many other antiquities that belong to the Greek and successive kind of Greek cultural periods, and they could fill that space, but it's not really under discussion right now. The main issue is, whether they will, leave or not, and they're not. There's no discussion of them leaving.
Konstantinos, could I please ask you, one of the long-standing, in fact, decades-old arguments for keeping them in this purpose-built Devine wing at the British Museum was that the British curators could take better care of the statuary. And when you answer me, just describe how much is there. There's the frieze, there's the various statues. But in fact, there were a number of cleaning assaults on the Elgin marbles that damaged them, right?
Archaeology is a relatively new science, if you will, and conservation, archaeological conservation, or the care of ancient objects, is even newer. Probably since the 60s and 70s, when new methods of chemistry and science were applied to conserving all kinds of objects, whether they're organic, like wood, textile, or pottery, glass, and stone. Stone has always been viewed as something much more durable because it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
So conservation methods, if you go back to the 1930s when various things were being conserved, various archaeological objects, including the stone, the so-called Elgin marbles, the way they were being conserved then, whether it was Britain or Greece or anywhere else, was not the standards of today. So we can't really go back.
But in the 1930s, wasn't there an attempt to restore them to a color they never were, to make them white when they'd been this kind of honeyed color?
One of the issues which was brought up just a bit earlier was this idea of Greekness, 2,500 years old, of this classical civilization. And one problem that we've had, at least from Northern Europe, is this concept of everything being pure and white. This whiteness, maybe it's Victorian or whatever, was the reason that they cleaned them. They wanted to clean them and make them purify, to make them white. Unfortunately, what they cleaned was not actually as much dirt as it was ancient paint. So yes, we did lose some of the original colors from some of the pieces, not all of them, by this cleaning process. But what I'm trying to underline here is that we can't go back to the 1930s when they were scrubbed clean and blame anyone, because this was a different standards of conservation all over the world, not just in Britain.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea also of them keeping them, making them white, is also something I think which just needs to be underlined, this concept of purity and whiteness.
Well, let's take a question from one of our callers. We're going to go to Cheryl, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Cheryl, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
Your question?
I'd like to ask a question based upon an observation. And the observation is that throughout the course of history, I think we can all agree that whenever one country conquers or one people conquers another, one of the things that they do that has nothing to do with subduing a people, actually more with suppressing them, is just to raid their art treasures. And recently, we can see this in Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, just the reports of how their libraries and museums have been raided is just really atrocious. But it wouldn't be the first time that happened. And I think the most egregious example would be during the Holocaust, when we all agree that the art treasures of Jewish persons were just stolen from mm-hmm. them en masse. And I just my question is, why is it wrong on one occasion and okay on another?
Okay, thank you. Well, Konstantinos, what do you think about that? I mean, she's basically saying that it's not moral
to
keep it, and comparing it to the taking of art under the Nazis and other acts of what we regard today as cultural
heresy. Yes, I mean, it may not be moral, but this is a fact of history. Throughout history, people are taking art from other civilizations. And maybe, what we should look at is, why did they choose Greek and Roman art? Why did the British or French and other Europeans? Because of the identity they may have had to this. And by bringing some of these cultural objects, these antiquity objects, they were trying to bring themselves up, make themselves more cultured. But yes, whether it's immoral and even illegal to take art is fine. But, I'm going back to the legal documents that were signed by the Ottoman Sultan, the Firman. These are legal documents. And even today
Firman was the writ.
Mm-hmm. Even today in modern Greece, where there are some land disputes, We go back to some of the Ottoman documents from the 19th century. So these documents are legal documents. So I don't think we can accuse the British of actually having stolen these.
Okay. Let's take another question. Dean is calling from Hyde Park, Massachusetts. Dean, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jackie. Thank you for taking my call. This was the point that I wanted to make, and I'm glad that someone has raised it. I think this is a thorny issue and complicated by the fact that the British didn't actually steal these pieces. They were permission was granted by the Ottoman authorities at the time. And I don't say this as a way of defending the presence of the Elgin marbles in the British Museum. I'm a Greek American, and I would love to see them back in Athens. However, I just think that this has to be considered that there was a legitimate permission that was granted, and it's ironic because Ottoman authority in Athens was several decades away from ending at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it persisted in the rest of Greece for some time, in Attica at least. It was over within a short 25 years. But because it was legitimate at the time, I think we have to consider this question, because I think when other objects are considered in other parts of the world, we look at whether they were stolen or purchased or whatever, and notwithstanding the issue of corruption or bribery, we wouldn't be returning objects to just anywhere if everything was stolen, but we do look at that issue of what was permission granted? Was it legitimate?
Okay.
And I think it raises the question of how legitimate that Ottoman authority was in Greece at the time anyway.
Okay, thank you, Dean. Well, let's put that to you, Brady Kiesling. I mean, these things were arranged from what we know legally in Ottoman times. Does that come up in these current discussions about what should happen?
Of course. People have taken a lot of looks at the Firman, whose content is very hard to puzzle out because it's written in this very obscure, oblique Ottoman language. And to meet diplomatic requirements at the time, I have a nice quotation from a wonderful book called Turkish Athens, where it says, "The Ottoman government had little feeling for the antiquities, apart from irritation at being continually pestered about them by either the British or the French ambassador, and valued them solely as minor instruments of foreign policy to favor friends or annoy enemies." In this case, Lord Elgin happened to be in Constantinople at a time when the British fleet had just done a major service to the Sultan by destroying the French fleet at the Nile. Therefore, with that goodwill and a certain amount of money in the right pockets, he got a very ambiguous piece of paper. Was the Sultan legitimate for the majority of his Christian population in Greece and elsewhere? Not really. Legitimacy is, are you willingly obeyed? And the average Greek in Athens would not have felt the Sultan very far away, completely indifferent to this alien civilization, had any right to make that deal, especially a deal that involved people being bribed where the Athenians would not benefit.
All right. Well, we
so
will
I
come
think
back.
From a legal point.
We will come back to that point in the next segment of our show. And we want to say goodbye to Konstantinos Politis, an archaeologist, Greek,
at the
British Museum. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the Elgin Marbles, the new Acropolis Museum, and the fight over culture and heritage and a people's national identity. My guests are, from London, Mary Beard. She's a professor of classics at Cambridge University's Newnham College and author of Fires of Vesuvius, Pompeii Lost and Found. And in Athens, we have Brady Kiesling, a former U.S. diplomat and trained classical archaeologist. Thanks very much, both of you, for being with us, all of us. And Mary Beard, you've been listening to our conversation for a little while. I know that you first saw the Elgin Marbles when you were a little girl in London. Could you just tell us about what that experience was like for you?
Oh, it was absolutely mind-changing. I was five, and we lived a long way from London. We lived right in the middle of the country, and I was being taken by my mum and dad to my first ever trip to London. And one of the things we went to see was the Elgin Marbles in the British Museum. And you know, I think that in some ways that was the moment when I decided to become someone who, you know, that was the moment I decided that I wanted to know more about the Greeks and the Romans, and it's kind of the origin of, you know, what's been for me an absolutely lifelong now engagement with classical Greece. So if you say, look, the Elgin Marbles in the British Museum really do act as an ambassador for Greek culture in a kind of international sense, I'm a kind of beneficiary of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was the Elgin Marbles that set me on the path to doing what I do now.
Well, that's a strong argument for keeping them there. I mean, presumably your parents weren't going to take you to Athens and more people get to London. How do you feel about this? I mean, do we need to have the original context to perceive something fully, or is there a very strong argument to be made for rehousing them in some other place where they can be contrasted to works of other cultures?
Yeah. Well, I'm one of the kind of very, very rare people who hadn't made my mind up about where the Elgin Marbles should be. And I think there's strong arguments on both sides, and it's not at all an easy question. And on the one hand, you've got the powerful sense that these things were made together, made to be a unified whole, and that it makes very little sense having a foot in London and the rest of the body in Greece.
Well, there is something sad about the goddess Isis being beheaded and separated from her body.
Yes. And it's hard not to be moved by the idea of a reunification. But on the other hand, I think there's, the other argument is not a foolish one, which says, first of all, look, you can't put the whole of this monument back together again anyway. A good percentage of the marbles have been destroyed. So we can't ever see the Parthenon whole again, and it can't go back on the building because of the environmental conditions. So there isn't a kind of way in which it can ever really be put back together. And you can add to that, and this is very much the British Museum's case now, which is there are all kinds of meanings that the Parthenon has and holds, and that if you put the marbles as they currently now are, as museum objects, inside a different sort of institution, which is a universal museum, where you see how Greece intersects and influences and develops on all sorts of other different cultural traditions, how you can see them next to Assyrian monumental sculpture or later Roman material, and also a whole kind of British and Northern European rediscovery of Greece in the 18th and 19th centuries. They're meaningful in that context too, and I think the British Museum's case is really, I think, that it is very hard. You can't undo the history of what's happened to these things. That it would be nice, in a sense, to wave a magic wand and see the Parthenon all back together again. And we would, in some ways, all like that. But that is not possible any longer.
You know, I just in doing a little research for this, I have not memorized all of Byron's Childe Harold's Pilgrimage, but even at the time, it was very controversial, and Byron objected very strongly and wrote, "Dull is the eye that will not weep to see thy walls defaced, thy mouldering shrines removed by British hands, which it had best behoved to guard those relics ne'er to be restored, snatched thy shrinking gods to northern climes abhorred." I ellipsed some of that, but, you know, It's amazing how long it's been an unsettled question.
It's partly an unsettled question because it's very hard to see now how to settle it.
Mm-hmm.
And from the very, very beginning, you're right, as soon as Elgin's there, it's controversial. And there's all sorts of bits of hypocrisy going on too, because Byron sort of does that real attack on Elgin, it's wonderful Byronic stuff. What most people don't realise, I think, is that when Byron was wanting to leave Athens just at the time, he actually hitched a ride on the boat that was carrying the last convoy of Elgin marbles out of Athens.
Oh dear!
So, you know, when it was convenient, he was quite happy to use Elgin's ship for himself.
Uh-huh.
And you get a load of people, like famous Cambridge antiquarian Edward Daniel Clarke, he tut-tuts terribly at Elgin, and it's also a powerful case against. And then a couple of years later, he decides to go and rip something off himself. So, you know, it's a very complicated world at the beginning of the 19th century in, you know, what shall we do? Shall we take them? Shall we not? And when the British government, when poor old Elgin, you know, who's probably foolish as much as a villain, and in the end he goes bankrupt with all this, his wife goes off with the next door neighbour, and Elgin is bankrupt, basically. It's far too expensive even for a rich aristocrat to shoulder. And he's trying to sell them to the British government. Eventually he does, although not for the price he wants. But that we have the verbatim records of the discussions that they have about whether to buy this stuff off Elgin. And, you know, even at that point in the House of Parliament, people are saying, well, should, you know, is this a legitimate thing to take? You know, do we approve of Elgin's taking the marbles? And a British Member of Parliament is actually saying, you know, in 1815 that they should go back.
Right.
There are also some people who say they're horrible and the British government shouldn't buy them because they're all battered and nasty.
I like that very much, Mary. Let's go to one of our listeners and see what she has to say. Kate is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Kate.
Hi.
So, what's your opinion about whether or not these should be returned?
Well, my opinion is I've traveled a little bit. I'm from Scandinavia. I'm now settled in Nashville, and I've been to the Egyptian Museum in Berlin, Germany, and I've been to the British Museum in London and a couple of others and in Chicago around the United States. And we have this Parthenon here, a copy in Nashville. And I think that making copies might be a great idea. My opinion about artifacts staying in the country of origin is adamant that they should be staying in the country of origin. However, I could see an exception to be made. Like if there is, so if it's a war-torn zone or if it's something where there is a chance that those artifacts might be destroyed, then maybe for safekeeping reasons until things calm down, artifacts could be held in another safe location.
Well, and that actually often, yeah. Okay, thank you, Kate. And that actually often happens. I mean, in Kabul, they were quite glad to have artifacts outside the country for a while. And Baghdad was until they were returned, and then the museum was, of course, looted. Well, what about the question, Brady, that Mary brought up, that really, there was a romantic appeal to this. You had talked early on about the sort of romance that the Greeks have for a Hellenic past that, in fact, never really existed because there wasn't a Greece as we know it until way post-independence. Brady?
It's crucial, I think, to understand that the Elgin marbles, the Parthenon marbles, are now frozen in time at a specific period of British imperial history that has nothing to do either with the original context of the art nor with the modern political and cultural messages that Great Britain is sending, that Greece aspires to send. That's why I argue we should put them back on the Acropolis to stand or fall with the rest of the Parthenon, to live the same lives as Athenians do, because that at least is an accurate reflection of the role that the marbles have played in history.
Mm-hmm.
Freezing them, creating an artificial standard of ancient classical beauty. We remember, they were painted brightly, they were set up with gilded bronze shields, with laudatory inscriptions. They were very garish at the time, and what we see now has no relationship with the Athens of Pericles, and trying to shoehorn ourselves into that version of Athens, it hurts us and it hurts the monuments. Let's let them live and die with us.
But it's so interesting, and I just can't resist the pun, the monumental question about what becomes important as a monument. For example, if you look at New York, people sometimes don't want things, garish or not, until they're gone. I'm not going to say that the World Trade Towers were garish, but they certainly became, they were controversial in terms of whether you liked their design or didn't, and they certainly became essential after they had been destroyed. So for both of you, I mean, what gives something emotional power? And sometimes it's after it's gone, like the statues in Bamiyan, for example. Brady, maybe come back to that and then Mary?
Well, the lack of the marbles, it's like a missing tooth in Greece. I believe that you should fill the missing gap with something that resembles your own teeth, not with something that is bright, shiny white. The Greece is, you know, it fights a permanent battle between a classical, quote, Hellenic identity and a Roman, Romaic identity, which is essentially Byzantine, a little Ottoman, a little Balkan. Greeks are in permanent unhappiness, measuring themselves against this impossible Hellenic ideal. The Parthenon marbles shouldn't play that role. They should be back helping in the worship of the goddess Athena, and if the goddess Athena is going to help the Athenians, they certainly need it.
Mary Beard, how important are these things really, though, to the British public? I mean, what would happen if, Nelson's column was suddenly removed to Tokyo?
Well, I'm always a bit unmoved about by those kind of arguments because I think in a funny sort of way, Britain's national identity isn't really bound up with particular monuments. So Greeks often say...
Not even Trafalgar Square?
Well, Greeks often say when you're kind of discussing the fate of the Parthenon marbles, they will say, how would you feel if, and they'll say... Stonehenge or Big Ben or the crown jewels, how would you feel if they were in Greece?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, of course, you know, one might miss Nelson's column a bit, but...
The pigeons would.
The pigeons become Pigeon Square only. But I don't think that any of those monuments have the kind of cultural pull on the British that the Parthenon marbles do on the Greeks. A better parallel might actually be to say, how would you feel in Britain if Shakespeare was... there was a law which said Shakespeare could only be performed in Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
I think you would have a tremendous visceral outpouring for that. But I don't think that Britain's sense of national identity is actually founded on any of those important symbols, interesting and loved as they are. Whereas I think that you were hitting the nail on the head, I think, when you were talking a few moments ago about loss, because it has often seemed to me that, and some of my Greek friends will say this, although they don't often say it on the record, it's not so much that the Parthenon marbles are the symbol of the Greek nation, it's in a sense the not having, it's the loss of the Parthenon marbles, the lack of the Parthenon marbles, which is that powerful symbol of Greek nationhood.
Right.
So in a funny way, I think that if the marbles were returned and put in the lovely new museum, they would become a much less powerful symbol of Greek nationhood than they are by being split and partly absent. And I do think you have to remember one very important historical fact about this, which is that the Parthenon marbles have not been important in Greece ever since the 5th century BC. There hasn't been 2,500 years of real admiration for the staff.
Well, right.
And the recent controversy really does go back to the founding of the Greek nation after the Greek War of Independence, the modern Greek nation, when in an absolutely ghastly war-torn country that had been under Turkish occupation for several centuries, the new Bavarian monarch and his advisors really, in a sense, the kind of political spin on 5th century BC culture in an absolutely contrived way of providing a national symbol for Greece. The new Greek nation was going to go back to the Athens of the 5th century, of Pericles and the Parthenon. And it was a hugely successful publicity operation. It isn't a kind of long, unbroken tradition back to the ancient world. It's a reinvented tradition in the 19th century, like so many traditions are.
Yes, exactly. But that doesn't make them less powerful. What was the price tag on this new museum, Brady Keesling? Do you remember?
Well, it was officially about 200 million euros, How much it really cost and who pocketed it, I have no idea.
Well, it would be interesting to know how many Greeks would go ahead and see this if indeed the Parthenon marbles, if you want to call them that, or the Elgin marbles were returned. But at least in the very short run, you'll have to go to London to see them. I want to thank both my guests, all my guests, for being with us on this really, really interesting hour. We've been talking with Mary Beard, a classics professor at Newnham College in London, in England, and also with John Brady Kiesling, an archaeologist, writer, former diplomat from Athens. Thank you both so very much.
Bye.
Bye for now.
Thank you.
And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook, and you're listening to On Point.